Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And also, you can send me an email. I would love to hear from you, your comments, suggestions, guests that you would like to have on the show. SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. Right now, I'm speaking with a distinguished author and professor all the way from the UK, Abdulrazak Gurna. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Thank you so much for being on the call today.
No, it's a pleasure.
You are, wow, an amazing writer, very fluid, visual, talking about a lot of issues dealing with immigration, a sense of identity, race, class issues, so much that we would need a couple of hours to really talk about all that you have written. one of your first novels, A Memory of Departure, is 1987. Your most recent book is The Last Gift, and a very interesting story. I want to read a little bit from the beginning here, just for the audience. This is from the beginning of The Last Gift. He felt it coming, the collapse. Not with the dread of ruin that had idled him by him for as long as he could remember, but with the feeling that something deliberate and muscular was steadily bearing down on him. It was not a strike out of nowhere, more like the beast that slowly turned its head toward him, recognized him, and then reached out to smother him. His thoughts were clear as the weakness drained his body, and in that clarity he thought, absurdly, that this must be what it felt like to starve, or freeze to death, or to have a stone crush the breath out of your body. The comparison made him wince despite his anxiety. See what melodrama tiredness can induce? Visually, I mean, a beast, you know, overtaking him. So what is this obsession with the immigration and class issues and sense of identity? Where did this come from? Is it because you yourself traveled from Zanzibar to the UK? Where did this come from?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, the part of it comes from just the experience of living here in Europe, in Britain, but having your origin somewhere else. Of course, this is not a unique or unusual situation. Millions of people are in the same situation. So what I write about is, on the other hand, not just my experience, but an experience, in a way, an experience of our times, a contemporary experience for millions of people, particularly with the movement from the South, as it were, to Europe.
Yes. What do you think the hardest thing for immigrants has been coming to the UK? What are some of the, is it the shock of food or racial issue, economic? What do you think is the most difficult thing that immigrants have to face?
I guess it depends when it happened and where they're from and that kind of thing. So, you know, so details are quite important. So, for example, for many people of my age, of my generation, they would have been coming to Europe pretty soon after decolonization begins. You know, mm-hmm. So the memories of empire and colonialism would be fresh in the minds of the hosts as well as of the immigrants themselves.
Yes.
You know, so there would be issues left over, historical concerns of various kinds. So people coming from the Caribbean to Britain in the 1950s and 60s would be thinking differently about Britain from the way, say, somebody like me coming from East Africa or somebody coming from India or et cetera. So details like that do matter. But the main thing, I think, especially for this period and these generations that I'm talking about, which I'm most familiar with because of, you know, I've personal experience of it,
yeah.
The main thing is the hostility, I think, that people encountered. Now, that may not be quite as true in the same way now, because now the issues are different. Now the issues are very much to do with economic concerns. You know, we're, you know, being flooded by all these asylum seekers and refugees, etc. That kind of language,
yeah.
Which is different from the language of the late 60s, which was a language of taint and contamination and hatred very often.
The things come out, though, in several ways. In my previous guest I just had on from Zimbabwe, but also in your book, one of the things, the daughter in the book she changes her name depending on where she is. You know, her parents give her Hannah. She calls herself Anna. And but yet, and so she too experiences, even though she's trying to hide, when she meets, you know, her boyfriend's parents, the incident where the uncle basically is berating her, asking her, "Where are you from?" And she's like, "You know, I'm British," you know. And he's like, "No, but where are you really from?" You know.
Yeah.
It made her, you know, she had to come out of hiding. Do you feel that in terms of identity, people try to hide a lot? I mean, in America, as an African-American, you know, people try to hide in the past. People used to try to pass being white, you know.
And
now, you know, people have arguments about how you wear your hair as a woman. Is it straight or is it natural? You know,
sure.
For other immigrants, how you dress. Are you wearing your traditional dress? Or are you wearing, you know, British clothing? There is a pain,
yeah,
though, in that. There is a pain and shame in that. Talk about that shame.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have those issues as well. I mean, not only for African Americans and passing, but you also have issues with more recent immigrants from other parts of the world, as well as from nearby parts of the world. So those issues are familiar everywhere, aren't they? The issues of how much do you acknowledge of your difference from the place where you are, and if you want to fit in, especially if it's not quite such a heady mix as you guys have over there. You know,
where
you have all the world there, where the mix is not quite so heavy as that. I think the desire, particularly for people who are born here, to be like part of the place, which is the only place they know, home. It must be quite difficult, especially when you don't have enough sense of. From your family, that is, enough sense of belonging to something else that is contesting that. So with this particular family, because the younger people don't know enough about their parents' lives, because the parents themselves have not told them for various reasons, because of that, there isn't something to compete with that sense of, I want to be part of this place. And
well,
I think go on.
No, as a parent, and you're a parent, I know that you have a daughter, I'm not sure if you have other, but as a parent, there's a lot of things that you don't want to tell your children. I mean, you try to shield them from, you know, the pain in the world. You want them to be happy and succeed and focus on the future, and sometimes you don't want to bring up the past. I mean, as a parent yourself, I mean, I'm sure there are things that you don't talk to your children about. Why?
Never.
Why would you
never.
Not? Yeah. This is not natural. I mean, and you know, as a child, do you want to know about your parents? Because sometimes you may not want to know as a child. Like, oh, there's too much for you to handle, you know, psychologically.
Yeah, sure. No, there's some things it's wise not to know, and it's wise not to tell for various reasons.
Yeah.
But obviously there has to be something, that connection, if you're of an immigrant ancestry. I mean, you need, I think, that connection. And the reason sometimes people don't give enough information about where they come from is partly because, I suppose, that information is shameful for whatever reason. It's very painful. Imagine if you grow up in a family of people who've had to kill in order to to get away, to save their lives, or indeed to kill because they were bad people themselves. But, you know, their lives have changed and now they're somewhere else. You know, there are things you can't tell. But you have to make a choice, obviously. You have to tell something to be able to provide some kind of sense of, not so much belonging, but a sense of the meaning of people's lives, your parents' lives, or your parents' place, whatever it was that formed them. Mm-hmm. And the choices sometimes that parents make, I take religion, for example. The choices that sometimes people make, they do out of love for their children, in order to protect their children, in order to save them the misery they've gone through. But, in fact, what happens is that possibly, I think, or at least this is my contention in the novel, what happens possibly is a sense of lack, a sense of something missing, an emptiness, and a desire for whatever it is that is being kept out of sight.
Always. I think, you know, the curiosity killed the cat is sometimes you're very curious to find out what's going on in the past or secrets. That's something that's in your book, a lot of secrets. Everybody has a secret. You know, Anna has a secret. Abba has a secret. Mariam has secrets. You know, how do you deal with secrets? You know, how do you share that? Some things you tell your friends, you don't tell your spouse. Some things you tell your spouse, you don't tell your father. I mean, everybody has a secret, you know?
Yeah, sure. And I suppose some of these secrets can turn quite sour and nasty, if only just for the person. I suppose in this family, what I'm saying is that there is a secretiveness as well, because the children grow up, and they're not children anymore by the time we meet them, of course,
mm-hmm.
because the children grow up in an atmosphere of suppressed information of some kind, or at least they sense that something is being suppressed. Well, they know that. Certain issues, when they come up, the subject has changed. So I think when you meet situations like that, or when you're in a situation like that, then you assume whatever it is that you're not being told is something shameful, something to
mm-hmm.
be ashamed of. And
mm-hmm.
if it's your father that's doing that, then, you know, fantasy and anxiety, I'm sure, takes over. And you imagine the worst possible thing that it might be, whatever it is that you're not being told. So, you know, I would think if you come from, you know, a place that is now going through violence, you would imagine, I'm sure, that what is being suppressed is something horrible that your parent has done or has been done to him. So secrets are of many different kinds, of course, but, you know, I think they tend to go bad if they're in intimate relationships or circumstances. You assume the worst.
I think that the secrecy issue, though, can bring illness, and that's another thing you talk about in the book, and health issues. And actually, the guilt can literally eat away at you and, I think, bring upon illness. You know, stress can bring illness. And you open the book almost, I'm like, is the guy going to die? You know, I mean, I learned later, I'm like, wow, you start almost with death in the opening of the book. And usually when you're reading, death is at the end, you know, when you open with this. You open with this, you know, I think that's very courageous. I want to read, though, one of the funnier parts, the lighter part. The father likes to tell stories to the children, and I remember my father and my mother reading to me. They're very fond memories. I have books still that my father used to read to me, and it brings a smile to my face. So I think that's a really touching moment. Let me just read a little here. This is where he's telling Hannah and Jamal the story. This is about the hyenas.
Oh, yeah.
This is the crazy part I thought was hilarious. There was another time when he spent a week in a tree while a pack of barking hyenas patrolled beneath him, raising their bums and firing streams of their poisonous shit towards him. Did you know that hyena shit scalds? It's one of their deadliest weapons. Hyenas fire shit into the eyes of their prey and then pounce. Their Ba had no choice but to climb as high as he could on that tree and hope that the hyenas would empty their bellies and run out of ammunition. He did not even dare doze in case he slipped off the tree. But then those powerful hyena jaws would crack his bones in one snap. So he would tell just hilarious stories. Do you tell stories to your children when they were younger?
Oh, yeah, no, it's great. I'm sure all parents do. But, well, I hope all parents do. It would be tragic if they didn't. Partly because children are such a good audience, that's one thing, that they actually believe what you tell them. So you can make things up even on the roof, as you are, if you're pushed. And they just love it. They love the wildest fantasies you can make up. It's great. It just goes down. And because you see them every day, I mean, it's not like some relative's child or something like that. But because you see your children every day, I often found that you could run these stories as a serial. You know, so you tell a story today, and the following day they want to hear, all right, so what happened to whoever?
Yeah.
And so you can keep it. And then these figures gradually become part of the family.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
So I do remember, you know, that. They knew, and of course some of the stories are true as well, so you would tell them about people that they'd never met, particularly in our situation where most of my family were and are still back in Zanzibar. So they didn't actually know many of these people, had never met many of these people. So I'm sure to them, these people that I'm talking about were also just as likely to be fantasy figures as those, you know, animals and camels and whatever that the stories abounded with.
Well, I think the issue of stories and fantasy is, in terms of immigrants, and I know my experience, a lot of friends who've come to America, they tell me, well, is this true? Did this really happen in America? Do you guys do this? And when I've gone outside the country, people make assumptions about me as an American. Well, you must go to McDonald's, or you drink Coca-Cola, you don't drink beer. I mean, it's hilarious to me, you know.
Yeah, sure.
What do you think the craziest story you heard about before you came to the UK? Do you remember any stories you were told about the UK before?
Yeah, well, there were plenty of stories, but also there were plenty of counter stories, you know, so that you had those stories of people going to the UK assuming that, you know, it was a place rather of great distinction, of great beauty, lovely buildings, pavement, clean, and all this kind of thing. But also, at the same time, even as a child, you heard stories of the opposite, of people who had gone assuming that and making fools of themselves because,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it turned out that it wasn't like that. So that it wasn't my expectations were not naive in that respect, because you already knew of people who'd come and gone. But I think, to be honest, the most surprising thing to me, shocking thing to me, I'm afraid I'm going to be a bit negative, the most shocking thing to me was, and the least expected thing to me, was the hostility that I met. That I had no expectation of that at all. I just had not. So it was, it's not as if, and it was stupid, of course, I should have done. But somehow, you know, you because I was reading the literature, English literature, I mean, and so on, and you read the news and listen to the BBC and all this, and that kind of courtesy and politeness that you see and read about, you just expect that that's the kind of thing that you will encounter. But you don't. You encounter bad words, ugly stares, and rudeness, at least. And but you're not used to it. Now,
yeah, well, I think
you've
been there for quite a while now, but I think even still in your writings and many of your other works, you talk... Your characters talk about the strange land. I mean, no matter how long they've been there, they still feel out of place. Do you feel out of place still in the strange land, you know?
No. Well, not in an uncomfortable way. Not in a way mm-hmm. that means that I'm sort of, like, tense or anything like that.
Yeah.
I have a good job. I love my job. I know the rules. I know how to get around. I know how to get things done. So, no, I'm okay. But it's... The other thing is that you think about another place as well. So it isn't only whether this is all right. This is fine most of the time. Although there are times when I'm kind of surprised. Like you walk past the shop window or something and you see a reflection and you think, who's that? Because you're not used to seeing yourself. You see, especially in England, where we live anyway, where it isn't that you live in a black community or in an immigrant community or something. I live amongst English people. So sometimes it's still a surprise to see a reflection of yourself. And I say, initially, of course, it doesn't last more than about a millionth of a second, but that sense
mm-hmm.
of who's that.
But
also think a lot about home and go home and write about home. I mean, you see the way I use that word, home. Home is still around the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes say, if somebody were to wake me up in the middle of the night and say, where's your home? I'm sure I'll just say Zanzibar, you know, without a second thought, even though I live in England. Which is not to say that this is a kind of a, something that makes it impossible to live or anything like that. It's just that's the reality. The reality is that I live here reasonably happily and comfortably and successfully, but also have an imaginative life, as it were, which is elsewhere.
Well, that's one of the things in your book, the main character, well, several of the characters, but the mother and father with their memories and how sometimes memories aren't true. They're not reality because you kind of make things up because you can't remember everything that happens to you in life, you know? And the character in your book of us is trying to, you know, when he's sick, he's remembering all these things. It was funny. I have a real quick story. I have a sister, and it's funny what she remembers from when we were little and what I remember. We have completely different memories of the same situation. you know, our father taking us to this place in Athletes and what happened when we went there. And I'm looking at her like, no, what are you talking about? Don't you, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, no, that's not how it was. You know, memories are very important.
I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. Because my brother and I, my elder brother and I, have about sort of like a year and a half difference between us.
Mm.
So we, all our lives until we left Zanzibar, we slept in the same room, went to the same school, most of the time in the same class, because we weren't different enough to be in different classes, you know, same friends and so on. And we still disagree about what really happened here, what really happened there. And we were there all the time together.
Together,
so I know exactly
right?
what you mean.
That's very funny.
But you know, something else happens also when you're away from family like this. You know, like when you migrate or dislocate yourself somewhere else for a long, long time. I think what happens in a community or in a family, if you remain within the community where you grew up, is that stories are constantly being readjusted. We all readjust all the time as we go along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're part of the people that you who are part of the stories themselves, there will be corrections. No, it didn't happen like that. It happened like this. It didn't happen like this. It was like so. So there will be a kind of debate going on, which is constantly corrected. The thing that happens, I think, to people who migrate or locate elsewhere is that this correction doesn't happen, so that something interesting happens then, because you can actually tell whatever story which makes sense about yourself. You can, in other words, reconstruct yourself. You can make yourself, you can clean yourself up, so that all the kind of ridiculous parts of you and your whatever childhood or adolescence, you can just leave them out. And this can be quite corrupting, I think. You know, so that you
well, that's what happens to your character. I mean, your character it hurt him literally. I think physically and spiritually. It hurt him with his intimacy. He could only be over so intimate with his family, his kids, and his wife, because he always put that wall up when they came to ask, you know, well, what do you mean? What's that, you know, what's that word or what's that place? What are you talking about? So I think in human relations, when there's that secrecy and that wall, then you can only be over so intimate. And I don't mean sexually. I just mean emotionally intimate with another person, you know. So.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's why I'm calling it corrupting, because it actually allows somebody like the character Abbas, but I think it's not unusual, but in any case, it allows people to actually suppress change. There's no reason why you shouldn't suppress things that that reflect badly on you. There's no reason why you shouldn't. But if there are things that actually transform who you really are, so it is corrupting, I think. It allows you to escape responsibility, to fail to acknowledge, you know, failure, and I think acknowledging failure and accepting responsibility are ways in which you grow stronger, in which you learn from things you've done. Whereas if you can just hide them out of sight, it means, in a way, you're not able to move away from them or move on from them.
I think they keep a hold on you. They keep a hold on you. You think you might have hid them and put them away, but it's a weight almost on you, a little shackle, if you will, on your ankle that you carry around. And you think people can't see it. See, that's the funny thing. I think we're very transparent as human beings. You think other people can't see that you're hiding something maybe, and sometimes we can't. But a lot of times people see it. They just don't speak to it because they don't want to, you know, bring up some mud, so to speak, or whatever, you know.
Sure. Yeah, it's none of their business either.
Exactly.
In a way, you know.
In a way,
it's more than the hurt. The hurting is the person who's doing it more than anybody else, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that even as we see in this case, in this novel, it's Abbas who's the one who's really in pain.
Yeah.
So it's the person with his guilt and his secrets who's hurting the most, I think.
Definitely. Well, you have so much to talk about. Like I said, I would love to have you back on again because you deal with so many issues that we can't even, you know, classism. We talk about foster care. You bring up in there is a wonderful issue, the issues of race. I wish you much success. A beautiful writer, very talented, and I just wish you much success to you and your family. And I hope that you come back on the show again.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for all those lovely words.
You have a wonderful Saturday.
Yeah, all right then. You too.
Thank you
for
listening.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I just got off the phone with Abdul Razak Gurnah, a wonderful Zanzibarian writer. This is his seventh novel, The Last Gift. He has many others you should check out. I was giving away some copies of this, so please follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeys. Become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful Saturday.